I have one more question, which is inspired by a recent conversation. I invited Michelle onto a podcast that I co-host that's about, broadly about questions of genre having to do with TV and film, and it was actually a really fun excuse for us to talk Star Trek. One of the things that we were kind of opening up in that conversation was just your personal experiences, you know, thinking through family evolution, maybe not recognizing it as such yet, right? So I wonder if you could share just your own story with this discourse, how you came to recognize yourself as a family abolitionist, what maybe some core experiences were in that. You don't need to talk about Star Trek, but.
Maybe we should just talk about Star Trek. So I came to the idea of family abolition quite late and came to it as an imminent process. I edited, was one of the lead editor of a number of people on a reader of revolutionary feminist writing, mostly out of anti-capitalist struggles. And I edited all these different essays by people at different moments of struggle in the 19th and 20th century who were talking about the family as that which they needed to overcome. And it was very striking because it became clear to me that they broadly agreed ethically. They were part of overlapping traditions, and yet what they meant by family kept totally changing, right? So like Marx and Engels are like, capitalism has already abolished the working class family. We need to go after the bourgeois one. And then Alexander Kollontai was like, the level of injustice in working class households, we need to have communism so that women aren't stuck at home cleaning and instead can fully join the revolution. And it's not immediately obvious that they are defining family in completely antithetical ways. The two of them, right? Just 60 years apart, at both Marxists, right? Or who knows what Marxists. But, and so I sort of engaged in this project of tracing the unfolding meanings of family in these struggles to go beyond it, and managed to map those onto a certain argument about the changing role of the working class family in capitalist reproduction. And so that becomes part one of the book, sort of tracing the changing meanings of family from the 1840s into now, and the changing meanings of struggles to go beyond the family onto changes in capital accumulation and the place of the family as a unit of working class reproduction. And I mean, obviously I could go into that argument at great length. It's a difficult one to summarize succinctly. But that, I sort of began to realize that the family was the core conceptual thread that tied together, that like thinking about gay liberation, thinking about women's liberation, thinking about the transformation of gender and sexual roles in society, there are a lot of ways of going about it. And I began to recognize the family as a sort of synthetic intersection of all these different unfolding dynamics and a way of mapping, understanding changing queer and gender politics, the changing sexual and gender politics onto the history of capitalism. So I found it very analytically helpful. And that's what led me to write my first essay on it. And I came to sort of the political conclusion slowly, just over the course of the last 10 years. Like, I've been a radical for a long time, but it's really just since like 2019 I began to be like, well, I actually think this politically makes sense. Like, I arrived at it quite late. But then when I did that, right, and you've been writing in this vein for a while, a few people have, when I came to that, when I sort of thought about it this way, I was able to retroactively see, you know, sort of after the fact, being drawn to different kinds of utopian imaginaries that included some element of collective life beyond the nuclear family. And one of those was my adolescent obsession with Star Trek. And this like fantasy of not only getting to travel to distant stars or whatnot, but like these people live with their friends. It's kind of amazing. They're on outer space communes, right? That are communists, they are socialists, they are beyond money, they are utopian in various ways, but they like live with people that they collaborate with, that they care about, that they work with, right? And something about that was just incredibly compelling to me growing up. I grew up here in Eugene, Oregon. This is where I'm from. And I was a very, very sad adolescent. I was a very sad kid. I'm trans, so I was a sad boy and not very good at it. And it didn't really work for me very well, you know? And it took being a part of many, many social movements and changing my gender and a lot of other things to like find my way out of that despair. And Star Trek, as you know, these flying space communes was an inspiration in that. And then new Star Trek shows come out every week now, so it's just a great time to be alive. I wanted to ask you, Madeline, so you alluded to the difficulties of writing about this topic, and you alluded to me a number of times about the complexity and density of the question of parenting, mothering, and thinking about family abolition. And you have written more deeply and more thoughtfully about children's liberation than I have. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about motherhood and childhood and how you've grappled with these topics.
Yeah. I want to promote an essay that just came out by Max Fox, who's a collaborator of mine. He wrote The Traffic of Children for Parapraxis, yeah, for which Michelle is an editor. And more recently for Lux Magazine, he wrote an essay called Free the Children. He actually interviewed me. Another instance where I was going to co-author something, and then I was just like, well, why don't you just interview me? I don't really know how to. I do struggle with how to write directly towards these issues and find myself writing around them more. But one of the central questions that we've been thinking about is how does one parent without outside of a property relation, right? And it is impossible for all the reasons that you just brought up. These things are individually insurmountable, right? I'm waiting for a revolution to happen so that I can relate to my child outside of property. And that's insufficient. My kid is growing up. And there's a sense of urgency in parenting. You're watching something slip away day by day. And it's frustrating, it's very, it's confusing. So I have been thinking a lot about this in terms of critical utopianism, which is a kind of, it's a branch of utopian thought that a scholar named Tom Moylan really cites as like coming out of the 70s with sci-fi writers like Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler, who are writing from a place of imminence. Right. So utopia is not a blueprint, is not a method, or is that, excuse me, not a blueprint or a program. It's more of a methodology, a way of thinking, a way of seeing that reckons with failure, that reckons with that sense of impossibility, and the melancholy and despair that come with that. That I want to have a different kind of relationship to my child, and we live under capitalism, and I cannot. and so what am I to do with that? Am I to resign to it? And certainly any parent does in moments of the day, resign to that sense of failure and impossibility. Do I struggle with it? How do I struggle with it in ways that aren't just about our individual relationship? how do I struggle with it in ways that can move beyond into a kind of collective shape in some way. So those are some of the kind of questions that I have worked through. And so I have, in writing about kind of a critical utopian motherhood or something like this, I have tended towards these other genres that are more speculative, that are more imprecise, that that are poetic, that are epistolary, that allow me, I guess, to inhabit this sense of imprecision and frustration, but in a way that I find also generative and inspiring. So how to, in other words, like work from that feeling of failure and impossibility towards a sense of revolutionary possibility, right? So even now I'm like, man, you don't really have good words for this, and maybe you're proving your point.
It's hard to talk about.
It is really hard to talk about. And so I've a number of times since 2017 sat down to write a version of a book, and instead I ended up writing a book of poetry. Instead I wrote an essay, or instead I get interviewed for something or something like this. It's frustrating. I don't know if I'll ever overcome it, but that's okay with me. because, yeah, I mean, this is part of why I think your book is a great resource for us. But I've found personally that being able to sit with those frustrations and sit with that sense of individuated failure to be quite profound and illuminating in terms of what I think my desires are, right? I really appreciate your point of what is the limitation. I also come from a Marxist feminist background, and a problem that Marxism needs to reckon with, or maybe it's just a reason why we should move beyond Marxism in certain ways, right? Is that there isn't really a way to account for desire or engage with our dreams or imagination, or just to move towards visioning, however imperfect, however speculative, however incomplete, to make use of these kinds of glimmers that we get from insurrection and build from them. So I find that also a frustrating thing about political theory, right, is that you write a piece of political theory, this is supposed to be comprehensive. I'm hearing one of the things you're saying is people are taking this to be a program, right? They're interpreting it as that. And I see that within the text, you're struggling against that almost inevitable kind of readership, you know, that political theory incites. But it hasn't been the genre I've wanted to inhabit with these questions.
Well said. So I wanted to invite Loa to ask the first question or two, and then we're open it up for the audience.
Cool. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I will just briefly, since Star Trek got brought up, canonically, the Federation is founded out of a successful global Trotskyist revolution. So just lore note, just fun. I've got so many places I could go with questions, but the one that I'm gonna go to, I think, is specifically kind of addressing the idea of abolition. And the book, particularly in the third part, does a lot of addressing why various people have sort of like refused to, like either said that it's bad or that they're not personally willing to do the speculation beyond beyond abolition, beyond the revolutionary moment. And it was making me think of something that happened recently in Eugene, which was the Healing Not Handcuffs campaign, which is there was a levy to put more money into the jail, up the jail. And the way that the campaign was largely structured was that it was like, hey, like actually instead of police, instead of the jail, we should have, you know, social services, we should have, there should be housing, there should be mental health care and everything. There's something about it that doesn't like work for me where I don't link those together. I don't think that instead of police, we should have social workers. I think that change should be provided for people, but I think that we get trapped into a model where when things become replacements for what they are right now, when abolition becomes about transformation, instead of being like, no, bad thing, bad, get rid of it, and these other things are other conversations, that we end up with things like, okay, now there's social workers who are, you know, tracking people, or we get the abolition, like the Reagan closing down of, you know, institutionalized mental health care, which, like, institutions were bad, but then it becomes, okay, it's in-home, but, like, with massive encroachments of, like, now surveillance that replaces that. And I think I'm wondering if you have an inclination towards the idea, where I have a hesitancy towards the idea of not towards speculation, but linking speculation specifically to abolition. And that I don't think that that's what historically the people you're addressing are doing. I don't think that they're rejecting speculation I think they're saying, okay, we want to abolish this, but I can't speculate. Yeah. But I think that there's, at least for me, something that is, no, speculation is good, but linking it to abolition chains it to the particular forms that are here now, and restricts the speculation, and sort of like recontextualizes speculation where we're trying to put things into particular, like, you know, puzzle pieces that are missing.
Right. I think you said it better than I could, and I think that was very coherent and helpful. A few thoughts related to this. One is, so many social institutions are actually forms of tremendous horrific violence and brutality and injustice, but they're also means of addressing actually existing social problems in a way that is compatible with profit accumulation in the overall dynamics of society, right, on some level. And we can offer better solutions, but those better solutions, recognizing that how much they kind of bear the print of the world that we live in. So the idea of replacing police with social workers is about imagining social workers as the means of managing large surplus populations of poor people that society has cast out, right, are not absorbed into productive work very easily, or really a marginal win of wage labor that funds, that enables a system of low-cost services of food delivery and lots of other things that we rely on. And that this is a much broader generalized problem, right, of what the place of poor people is, the survival of poor people, that has deep structural conditions. And a certain amount of unmanageability is really built into it, and perhaps even politically necessary for change. And but the question becomes, how will you keep these people contained? What will you do to make sure these people don't get out of hand, right? And the left steps up and been like, well, we will replace police with social workers, and social workers will keep them contained. Social workers will control them. Social workers will keep them from killing you, right? And that's what the left becomes in the process, rather than actually being able to talk about structural solutions, rather than actually being able to raise questions about why there are so many poor people, and can poor people be agents in a social transformation as a link of a much broader struggle of the multiracial working class. And so that's, I'm trained as a social worker, I worked in aid services for a long time, and there's no question that social work is really dominated by carceral impulses, by dynamics of what it takes to control and discipline poor people. And the history of social work is very tied up with that, you know, of wealthy bourgeois ladies who would visit poor people's homes and tell them how they should live, right? That was a huge part of it. And so there's, you know, a long history of kind of social control and the history of the family. Like, one of those things the bourgeois ladies did is try to teach working class people how to live like them in their family structures and in their family decision making. And, you know, of course, visiting bourgeois ladies don't have that much impact. It took some much broader social forces to unfold for working class people to be able to form families. But these kind of structural questions, I think we have to ask ourselves over and over again. And one of another piece of this is a lot, I wrote, we have a new book, Pinko has a new book out called After Accountability that you can pre-order. It's on a crate in the Pacific right now. And I wrote a closing essay in it talking about abolition and community, ideas of community that are related to the conclusion of this book. And one of the things that I say is when prison and police abolitionists talk a lot about community-based solutions, they are misreading some key things that police and prisons are for, which is the defense of property. And of course, police and prison abolitionists know this, but like, the police are a fairly modern institution. Ingalls talks about special armed gangs of men as an integral part of class society. That as long as there has been property, private property, as a social form, there have been groups of armed people defending it. And that that is a really major part of class history. And that if we want to drastically reduce the role of police in our society, we have to drastically transform the place of private property, like what it means to be poor or not. And I think that that's something that a lot of people know and surprisingly don't say that often. It connects to a lot of other things, but do you have some thoughts about this?
I want to hear more questions, honestly.
Okay, so let's
your responses.
Let's open it up for the audience.
Run a mic.
If it goes, sure.
Yeah. So both of you have spoken about revolution, not a lot, but a little bit, and I just wonder exactly what you mean by that, because when I think of revolution, I think of a violent overturning of the political order replaced by something wonderful for a brief time, which is then taken over itself by forces that are repressive in a different way. So I wonder, where are you going with this notion of revolution when you speak of it?
I think if there's any hope for humanity at all, or the vast majority of species on this earth, we have to get out of class society. We have to get out of a system where capitalist profit is the governing fundamental principle of how we allocate the vast majority of social resources and human time and human ingenuity and creativity. You can think whatever you want, and we can talk about it, but we have to get out of that. And I don't think there's any way of getting out of that without crushing the capitalist state and having a global armed rebellion, among other things. That the dynamics of private property, that states are built to defend them and built to reproduce them, and that that's been true for a very long time. And that what it will take to form a global revolutionary movement capable of crushing the capitalist state and overcoming private property is a very good question. And I think we are in a crisis where existing scripted models of what revolution should look like or could look like clearly don't work. And frankly, scripted clear models of how to get reform or even a marginally less horrific society also don't really seem to work, right? Reforms happen sometimes, but there was a political era, I think, when a lot of people could connect to an idea of how social change actually functioned, and that right now we're in a moment where we really don't know, where there's a deep level of uncertainty about how to proceed, about how to get anything decent at all. And that's real. That's totally real. And I don't have the answers to that, right? I mean, I have been influenced by different revolutionary traditions that have sort of clear accounts of this. And I don't particularly have a clear, confident idea. The revolutionary tradition that I engage in this book the most, well, I engage a lot of traditions, but the set of ideas I engage repeatedly is communization, very obscure post-1968 French communist tradition. And it really is interested in what actually happens during uprisings, not what kind of institutions, if there was enough political will, could be created out of an insurgency, but really looking at the insurgency itself, the experience people actually have during riots or occupations or big strikes, and the forms of governance that emerge during them, the forms of problems that people have to overcome, and the types of thinking about what a free society could be that emerge during periods of insurgency, and trying to learn from those, trying to extrapolate from those, trying to imagine from those, and recognizing how different models of socialism or different models of change throughout history have reflected particular kinds of experiences of work and its overcoming. And so it's a theoretical question that is deeply, deeply unanswered. And I think we're living in an era where it is more unanswered than ever. And it's a question that we have to be asking ourselves over and over again and trying to think beyond. In the novel, we tried to propose a revolution, a scenario where a revolution was possible, and involved the catastrophic and horrific collapse of capitalist trade as a functional system of survival. Right? Involves a level of crisis where the capitalist state is no longer able to care for anyone, and what could emerge out of that, right? And that's not something I wish on our world, right? If we came up with a better idea, I'm all for it.
Well, the only thing I want to add to that, which I think is lovely about the third part of this book, is what I heard you saying is revolution is a violent overthrow. It leads to something briefly beautiful and hopeful that will inevitably be overtaken by counter-revolutionary forces. And I think that sense of inevitability is shared among most of us. It's largely what prevents us from actually really thinking deeply about revolutionary possibility. And it's a strong case to speculate, which I think, I would say not the bulk of the third part of the book, but a lot of the revolutionary visioning that Michelle is doing in the third part of the book is also anticipating counter-revolutionary forces and thinking through different contingencies, and that counter-revolution is, you know, absolutely an obstacle in thinking revolution, but absolutely not a reason not to think it, right? So that's the only thing I'd add to that. But that sense of inevitability, I would say, is something that we mutually question. Earlier versions of that were, you know, Cold War fear of totalitarianism or things like that. It would have to lead in that direction. And I think that that's something that, this text is not afraid of reckoning with those kind of dystopian apocalyptic crises that will probably emerge in these kinds of scenarios, but that they require these kinds of speculative tools, these imaginative thought experiments, and these type of things to prepare us collectively. So it's an imperfect answer, but I think to rest on the questions and not a sense of certainty or prediction, right? I think prediction is a very different thing than speculation in this sense too. So I don't know if that's sufficient.
And of course the place of the family and all that, that one of the major mechanisms of counter-revolution in actually existing historical revolutionary processes is when the family is sort of reintroduced as the primary unit of social reproduction. That, you know, there was a moment in, I mean, the what happened in the Russian Revolution. There's a lot we can say about why it failed or where it ended up. But there was a moment that huge tens of thousands of Russian women were forming canteens and creches as a strategy of survival and saw the new societies coming out of that. And the, you know, the leadership of the Bolshevik Party initially was okay with that, and Kollontai backed it as a means of bringing women into the revolution, of mobilizing women's working capacities. And when the Civil War was over, they were like, yeah, no, we don't actually think that's a great idea. I mean, sure, there could be a couple more canteens than usual. Sure, neighbors can know each other a little bit more than they do in the capitalist world. But actually, families are the way to go. And they reimposed the family as a core, basic element of Russian society, and they did it in the interests of social order and natalism, in the interests of promoting birth. And there's a whole history around that. And so the one of the forms the counter-revolution takes is the private household. We might not be able to get the mic to
I got one but, that's yeah? goes with what you're saying. So what occurs to me is during disasters like Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, the family did no good at all.
Right.
So, and then just to touch on what you're saying, though, that the mutual aid societies are what save those situations. There's stories of people going around saving them. And then just one quick thing, though. The Star Trek, there's a Star Trek episode maybe you're familiar with where the planet is going to be destroyed. So all the women, they're going to do polygamy to repopulate the world. So, and you know, in the Dr. Strangelove too, I'm going to wrap this up, Dr. Strangelove too, all the women are in the bunker, in the nuclear survival bunkers, they're going to be made to make babies. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I mean, it could work both ways. A disaster could work both ways, I guess is what I'm saying. But I think we need a disaster.
I'll just briefly mention, the women that are speculated never actually appear in the film.
So yes, I think you can certainly look at disasters and catastrophes, and people do very much make plans, or prepper plans that are based on their nuclear families, often that involve guns and stored food. And those people are horrific to have as neighbors. It's just a disaster, right? In more ways than one. And there's no question that many, many people churn the collective strategies of mutual aid in catastrophes, as they do in rebellions, and that it becomes an encounter, right? And I talk about this with COVID, right? Tens of thousands of people in New York City went and talked to every one of their neighbors during COVID, right? And it was incredible. It was really quite a moment of sort of glimpsing something beyond the nuclear family as the primary unit of survival in this environment, in this context where we're all encouraged to like shelter in, you know, with our pod, with our nuclear families in isolation. Was a chance for lots and lots of people to go next door and to be like, do you need help getting groceries? And very importantly, it was a breakdown in capitalist commodity chains, that the counterpart to the nuclear family is the grocery store and the box store. And they are built in together, they rely on each other. And in New York City, where 20,000 people died over the course of a couple of months from COVID, the grocery stores were empty in many, many working class neighborhoods, and people had very limited options around getting food. And so suddenly these networks of neighbors transporting groceries for people, connecting to farmers and CSAs, like became connecting to soup kitchens, became a huge part of survival for many, many people. And it was very short-lived, as it often is, as sort of commodity chains get reintroduced. But I think that's a very good example of sort of how the family relies, the nuclear household, the private household relies on this whole architecture of capitalist society in order to function. And if any of those pieces break down, the family doesn't really work in the way that we pretend it does, that it requires a very different set of relationships. One of the things I say very briefly in this book that actually I think I should write an essay for Blindfield, the journal that Madeline edits Sunday, is that one of them is that if the commodity stores break down, if the box stores, grocery stores break down, or we have generalized social crisis that gets worse and worse, there the nuclear family cannot function in that environment, but a cult can. And the cult or the commune are the two choices, right? And what is different about them, right? I mean, it's not straightforward, right? Some cults are nice, some communes are mean, right? So like what, and for me, the biggest difference is the cult is what it takes to reproduce it as a unit in a sustained way. And the commune is about opening on to broader processes of transformation. And this connects to how I think about communist revolution, that like the where I would locate the nightmare of counter-revolutions is what it takes to make the revolution survive in the capitalist world. That like actually, if a socialist workers' revolution happens in a place, it will be a failure if it doesn't become global. And one form of that failure is what became the Soviet Union. There are other forms of that failure, perhaps much worse ones, right? And so one thing that I think about is our future will not be one of nuclear families. It will not. Like the level of ecological crisis will make that impossible for the vast majority of humanity. It will either be one of refugee camps and religious cults and authoritarian collective living facilities of various sorts and homeless shelters and, you know, institutional practices of collective living that are authoritarian and that are disturbing and are bad, or it'll be one of the commune. And whatever that means, you know, as a transformative space of love and collective care that expands outwards, right? That has to expand outwards in order to be able to survive, in order to be able to be something other than the cold. And so one of the ways of sort of parsing science fiction stories is in watching the sort of unfolding of the commune or of the cult, often in tension in various recent accounts like Station 11 or various other recent shows that I think depict this in a very rich way. And that you close off the access to the outside, you seal off the borders, and what you have is a cult, whatever it is you want.
Thank you so much, both of you, for this extraordinary talk. I was wondering if you would like, or if you would be able to speak a little bit more of how you see the relation maybe of family abolition to gender abolition, just because of the crux of gender and heterosexuality in that, in relation to property as well. So if you maybe could elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, that's a theoretical project that I have not undertaken. I do not have an answer for that. I don't engage that in this book. In the novel, transforming the radical transformation in the gender division of labor leads to an intense diversification and proliferation around gender. That in post-revolutionary society, 40-some% of people are trans, and within that are a sort of radical experimentations and transformations around gender. And I am, trying to thinking about the rise of trans children, as, trans children have been around for hundreds of years, and there's been medical support for trans children for decades now. But there are a lot more trans children in the world right now, coming out and arguing with their parents. And I think that's something that gives me a great deal of hope, and I think about it a lot. And how remarkable it is on many levels. And I very much think, would attribute it among other things to a kind of loosening of gender roles that's happened over the last few decades. But I very, very much think that a revolutionary process that transforms how labor is organized would inevitably lead to a much richer, much more complex human relationship to gender than we have right now. And then I think, it's funny, I spent a lot of time talking about abolition as this, in the Hegelian sense, as the simultaneous destruction and preservation and unleashing and transformation of something, Aufheben, and it all its rich meanings. And I've struggled with it around gender in the ways that people struggle around family evolution. Mm. And I think it might have something to do with a kind of psychoanalytic resonance and a kind of resonance like one of the basic social facts that fascinates me and that I take a lot of solace in and I think about a lot is how poorly conversion therapy works, which is so interesting, right? Gender is clearly socially constructed, it's historically variable, it unfolds over time, and yet you take a trans child and put them through conversion therapy, they come out the other side unhappy every time. And they stay unhappy for a really long time until they have a chance to do something different with their gender. And how strange that is, how remarkable that is, that there is a level of unconscious identification around gender that goes very deep in the constituting ourselves as subjects that can take many, many different forms in the world, but that if we don't have a chance to take seriously, the consequences are really quite negative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's compatible with the gender abolitionist framework, but that sometimes that the sort of strange immutability of gender identification in the failure of conversion therapy is something that I think about a lot. Yeah,
I would just say, something I really appreciate on this note, though I'm fascinated by what you just said, is you write about the family ideal, right? And the family ideal, not as a reality, but right, but as having this kind of disciplinary function over us that has to do with white supremacy, that has to do with gender normativity and sexual normativity, right? So I think that's a powerful, maybe it's the thing to think about next, right, is making that link more clear. But I see that as a very clear link in how you discuss specifically how the family is idealized under capitalism, right, and the violence of that ideal, how it hangs over our attempts to create different kinds of social relationships. So.
And I do contrast that family ideal to what I call gender liberation, and I'm a little unclear about what that is, but it probably has something to do with what people mean when they talk about gender abolition. So I propose one more question. We've been talking for an hour and 40 minutes, and I want to encourage everyone to buy lots of books, not just mine. And if you want your book signed, I'm happy to do that. I love the signed books I have. So let's go with one more question, please, in the back.
Hi. I'll start out by saying, for Star Trek fans, there is a free play in the park today at 5 and tomorrow at 5, and it's a redo of an episode of Next Generation.
Wow. Which park? Which park?
Oh, Amazon Park. So I just finished reading a book called Restoring the Kinship Worldview, and it is a collection of precepts from Indigenous voices, and it seems like a lot of the precepts and the discussions of them, a lot of it leads back to a concept that the editors called the evolved nest, and I'm wondering if you know about this concept, and if your book, how that concept might mesh with your third part in the utopian vision of it, and or if any ideas of Indigenous family come into play in your book.
I'm not familiar with the concept of evolved nest, and you're welcome to share more about it if you'd like. There is a very rich literature of Indigenous writing on both the history and politics of the family and on thinking expansively and dynamically about kin relations, including thinking about what it means to take seriously kin relations with non-human beings. And relating changing relationships to property and land to changing dynamics of kinship, right? That and that literature is certainly one that informs me. Lou Cornham has written quite movingly about indigenous communism, and we work together in Pinto. And in this book, I engage some of literature around becoming kin and making kin. And it definitely has something to do with how I think about communizing care. I also engage much more extensively with the history of settler colonialism in the family. And I'll say a few words about that. And this is all from indigenous scholarship and writing about settler colonialism, that there were sort of two, often colonies, initial colonists were often men organized in military structures to varying extents. There was a huge part of conquest, including in North America. But in order to get the colonies to stabilize, they needed women. They prioritized trying to figure out how to get married couples to move to the frontier. And this was a huge concern. And they recognized nuclear families, white nuclear families, as the absolute foundation of being able to build nations. You could not have a settler nation with just men, right? And so there's a whole history around the settler family and the centrality of heterosexuality and private property in that. And then meanwhile, a whole history around indigenous genocide. So of course, indigenous people around the world have had many, many different ways of organizing relationships, kinships, intimacy, including many examples of queer relationships, collective property, sort of not family, not a property, not arising, sitting exclusively with an individual or a family was extremely common in America. So very different ideas of property, and very different ideas of what constitutes a primary relationship, and various kinds of collective housing. Collective living, collective kin relations were very, very common. And of course, the settlers, the colonists, were just horrified by this. The Catholic Church and missionaries and settlers and settler states, that indigenous kin relations was a major effort around destroying it. And there were two very different, I mean, they happened concurrently, but I really focus on Canada and North America. Then meanwhile, you know, there were these huge campaigns around exterminating people, killing everyone, forcing them off their land. But then there were two strategies that really focused on the question of kin and family. One strategy was separating children from their parents. So that, which, you know, there's a parallel in what happened during slavery and the Negro alienation. And children were put into what were called residential schools or Indian boarding schools or other things, initially run by the Catholic Church, and later they got some state support. And they were really instruments of mass torture and mass death. And, you know, there's been all these news stories just over the last couple of years about digging up these mass graves at these schools. And their efforts were really trying to make children white, right? They banned speaking any language but English. They sometimes assigned children out to white families, like adopted them out, and really figuring out how to attack and destroy the kin relations amongst indigenous people. And this has always been a part history of the family, right? This has always been central to what the family is, that certain families count and other care relations need to be destroyed. But then almost simultaneously, there was another strategy, which was allotments. So they seized indigenous land and they redistributed it to indigenous people based on family ownership, based on individual male-headed nuclear family structures. And this was an effort at destroying the collective property, collective governance, and collective life of indigenous nations. And allotments were developed in the United States, but also taken up in Canada under other names. And so here, the nuclear family was the instrument of genocide. It was the strategy of genocide. They also, in the process, took a lot of land and sold it to white people and other things. But the idea being an individual indigenous family is just another family, right? They could be foreclosed upon, they could borrow money, they could sell to white people, they could do all sorts of things with their property. And what's destroyed is what is beyond the family, the care relations, the collective property relations that characterize Indigenous life. So this is, I think this is extremely illustrative of the history of the family, right? You have on the one hand settler families that count, and then on the other hand, you have the simultaneous processes of trying to separate parents and children, or alternatively, force them into living in a nuclear family arrangement based on private property. And so that for me is really, was like piecing that together in the literature was really quite powerful, quite helpful to me. Okay, so let's end there. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Mary.